I was suggesting last night that the reason for a series like this is that it is my experience and the experience of very many people that the basic reason that a large number of otherwise thoughtful people have rejected and dismissed Christianity is simply that they have never taken the trouble honestly and seriously to inquire into what it is that the Christian faith really says. And the purpose of these meetings in the evenings is that we might try to do this together. I said last night too that it's important to distinguish, as I think it very seriously is, between genuine New Testament Christianity and such substitutes for it as often cloud the thinking of many people, as for example a kind of dead institutional ecclesiasticism, which is many people's only encounter with anything that goes by the name of Christianity. I want to say again that I hold no brief for that particular institutionalism. What I am concerned about in these evenings is to try to disentangle for you the basic elements of the authentic Christian gospel. And however it may have been overlaid in history and throughout the various branches of the church, I think there is no question that it is possible to discern and disentangle the basic elements of New Testament apostolic Christianity. And this is what we are being concerned with here. Last night, we began, as John Palmer has just been saying, at the only possible starting point for any understanding of Christianity, and that is with the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Christianity stands or falls by his claim that he is simply not a great moral teacher, but as he states again and again in many different ways at which we looked last night, he is God in his person and in his nature. This is the foundation of everything, and we need to come to some conclusion about this remarkable person and the quite astounding claims, when you examine them, that he makes about himself. Now, I think it may be obvious that the next step in our inquiry is to examine what is the Christian view of man. And I want to suggest that we take the same approach as we did last night, where I suggested that the two basic elements in our approach to this subject would be an honesty which is ready to come to it with an open mind, that is, open at both ends and in both ways to be convinced one way or the other, and to try as much as possible to jettison presuppositions which may be due to an encounter with some of the substitutes for Christianity. And the other qualification that I suggested we needed was diligence, so that we are ready really to give our minds to thinking through some of these issues together. Now, Christianity's basic claim is that God has entered human existence in Jesus Christ, not as a myth like some kind of Greek story, but as a fact of history which is soberly recorded and can be dated within something like 3 or 4 years at a town which can actually be visited. We are dealing, in other words, with historical, verifiable facts of the presence of Jesus Christ in history at a particular time, who claimed to be God. And his basic claim is that to look upon him is to look upon God. Now, this is how God reveals himself, not in a set of logical propositions, but in a living person. But in Jesus Christ, there is not only, according to New Testament Christianity, there is not only a revelation of God in character and speech and actions, there is also the perfect picture of man. This is not only what God is like. The presence of Jesus Christ in history bears witness, according to the Christian faith, to what manhood is intended to be. So Jesus bears witness to the fact that man occupies a unique place in God's creation, When God came into the world to reveal himself, it is of the utmost significance for true Christianity that he came as a man, and thereby showed us not only what God is like, but what true manhood is meant to be. Not only is man the summit of all God's creative work, he is also made in the image of God. This is the basis of the biblical view of man, and you have to begin here. It is recorded in the book of beginnings in the Bible, the book of Genesis. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created them, both male and female. And Jesus, I say again, not only confronts us with God, he confronts us with God in human form. And the question that I want us to address ourselves to first of all is, what exactly does it mean that man was made in the image of God? It means certainly that he was made to reflect some of the characteristics of God, and there are certain of these that you can clearly discern. And I want to pick out one or two of the most important of them, and I want us to think through the significance of them. When Christians say that man is made in the image of God, they mean first of all that man has a capacity for love and for self-giving, a capacity which he was intended to use, according to the Christian scriptures, primarily towards God and then towards others. This is the basic mark of man made in the image of God. He was made in order that he might exercise this love and self-giving towards God and then towards other people. This is why you get the commandments beginning, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and soul and mind and strength," and the other part, "and thy neighbor as thyself." Now it is in this sense, first of all, that man bears the image of God. He has this capacity for love and for self-giving. The second thing being made in God's image means is that man has a will of his own. Love demands this, obviously, if you think about it. It is the free response of an independent will and can only be voluntary. You can never condition someone to love you. And love demands that man has a will of his own. And it's reasonable, therefore, that if man is made in the image of God, he should have his own autonomy. Now, in the same book of beginnings, the book of Genesis, you find the picture of man placed in a garden where he is free. And there is no fence around the tree that he is forbidden to partake of. He can give his love and obedience freely to his Creator, but he can equally also reject his authority. He has this freedom to love and obey, and he has the responsibility to heed the words that have been given to him by his Creator. He has been given certain instructions, and he is free either to disobey them and disregard them, or to obey them and live by them. The third thing that being made in the image of God means is that man has a position of derived authority within the whole sphere of creation. And this is the Christian and biblical picture of man in the world. While all ultimate authority belongs to God, he has delegated some of this authority to man. And this significance that God has attached to man is one of the fundamental things that Christianity has to say about man. And it is something which is apparent in the world and has baffled philosophers in almost every age. The comparative significance of man against the background of the whole of the creation. For example, you get the psalmist in the book of Psalms, in Psalm 8, quoted in one of the New Testament letters, saying this. And it is an age-old problem and puzzle that men have gone over again and again. "When I look at your heavens," he is speaking to God, "the work of your hands, the moon and the stars which you have established, what is man that you are mindful of him? In the face of the vastness of the universe, he says, what is man that you even take the trouble to think about him, or the son of man that you care for him? It seems incredible that God, if he is the creator of the wide universe, should have any personal interest in man who appears so insignificant. Now this is something that penetrates even deeper in a generation like ours, where we have discovered something more of the sheer vastness of the universe, and of areas far beyond the thinking of men before our own day. And yet, the psalmist goes on to say, you have made man nonetheless only a little lower than God, and you have crowned him with glory and honor, you have given him dominion over the work of your hands, and you have put everything under his feet. Now you see what this means. It means that man, according to the Christian view of him, is put over the whole created order in the purpose of God. He is expected to find out and use the whole resources of the natural order, and to name all living creatures. This is the position that God gives to man. And this, as you will see too, is the foreshadowing of the scientific quest, whose aim is to understand and classify and use the whole natural order for man himself. And this is the divine charter, of course, for the immense variety of human activity in areas like technology and agriculture and industry and the arts. Man is put in charge of the creation. He is the one who is in dominion over it, and he is the crown of God's whole created order, and everything that God has made, he has made in order that man might rule over it. These are all God's gifts, in other words, for the enrichment of man's life. It is therefore important to say that it's no part of the authentic Christian case to denigrate or belittle human achievement. This is no part of Christianity's thinking about man. We recognize that the biblical position puts man at the highest possible level in creation. But when the psalm is quoted in the New Testament, the New Testament writer sees immediately the problem of human experience, which he has to set alongside that picture. And he puts it alongside it like this. He says, man has been set in creation with everything put under his feet. He says, this is the position that you have given to him, O God. Now the New Testament writer puts human experience alongside it, and he says, but we do not yet see man so ruling over the creation for the good of humanity and for the glory of the God who has made him. And even if you are not interested in what his relation to God is, you must see that what we see as we look around the world is precisely this problem the New Testament poses alongside the psalm. We do not see man in this position for which he was made by God. What we do see is that far from being able to control the things that God has given him power over for the enrichment of his life, we discover, particularly in our own contemporary generation, that he is cowering in terror, lest the very things that he has discovered and made turn round to rend and destroy him. Now this is the human experience, which is the problem that is to be posed alongside this exalted picture of man. In all his dignity and greatness, he has tamed so much of the world. He is able to discover and understand and use so many of the natural forces, and yet the very things that he has made, he himself lives in dread of. And in our own day, this is true at political levels. It's true in places where men are discussing how we may prevent men incurring genocide on whole nations. It's true when people are meeting to discuss what we are going to do about nuclear stockpiling. There is a certain area of life over which Manu was intended by God to control the world and the created order, has no control whatsoever. And we see today a potential for destruction, which is of course quite staggering. This is the evident tension, then, between what man was created for and how he actually lives. And it is apparent that there is a tragedy at the heart of things. We do not yet see all things put under him. Now, the reality of this is what produces despair in the thinking and writing of so many of our contemporaries. If you are even superficially acquainted with some of the writing of our own times, you'll discover that it is precisely this problem, the problem that man has not yet got the whole of the created order under his control, and he has become rather a fugitive in the universe. One of the secular existentialists takes up this phrase, the not yet of man's progress. He sees the real problem that man has not achieved what some of the optimistic forefathers that we read of thought that he would achieve. And he sees nothing but disillusion and despair. Jean-Paul Sartre writes, the sound which drowns out all hope for man is not just the tolling bell of not yet, but the death knell of not ever, not ever. And what the disillusioned secular existentialist sees as he looks into the world and into the human situation is not just that man has not yet achieved this, but that the prospects present him with nothing but despair. Now, what is the explanation we now need to turn to ask? The explanation of this tragic contrast between what man has been made for and what he is. I want to look at one or two possible answers to this question and then at the Christian one. One answer to the question, of course, lies in what one might describe as an optimistic philosophy of evolutionary progress. This is the position, as you may know, of such humanists as Julian Huxley, and more recently of one of the chief humanist spokesmen, H.J. Blackham, who in the Humanist News in 1969 wrote these words. He speaks of a new hope of man's transformation of himself in the world, which is the unquenchable humanist faith. Now, it's obvious to everybody that man's material lot has greatly improved through such advances in technology and medicine and the righting of social wrongs that we have seen even in our own time. But the vital question which we must ask, cutting below this kind of thinking, is, has modern man himself, man come of age as some modern writers are speaking of him, has he really changed in his essential nature? And that question, I suggest you, requires a very different answer. When we see progress of so many different kinds, the essential issue is, has man in our generation essentially changed? Voltaire in Candide wrote a biting satire against the extreme optimism of the 18th century, which is still a cautionary tale for some forms of humanism. And I say carefully, some forms of it. But it is an important issue that he raises. Dr. Pangloss, who has been the main influence on Candide, brought up in an optimistic faith, has so influenced him that he faces ultimately a series of shattering experiences which give the lie to the philosophy that he has learned. And at one point he asks a friend, and I quote, in the midst of his disillusion, when he finds that the philosophy does not fit the facts, do you think, he asks, that men have always massacred each other as they do today? that they have always been false, cozening, faithless, ungrateful, thieving, weak, inconstant, mean-spirited, envious, greedy, ambitious, bloody, slanderers, hypocritical, and stupid. And the friend asks Candide whether he thinks that hawks have always eaten pigeons. Candide agrees that they have. Well, is the reply, if hawks have always had the same character, why do you suppose that men have changed theirs? Now, some modern men, many of them indeed, do not seem to reckon with this quite basic fact, even in the face of the testimony of human history. It may be that Hegel was speaking all too near to the truth when he said on one occasion, history teaches us that history teaches us nothing. Another suggested answer to the problem of this tension between what man was meant to be and what he is given in terms of environmental factors. That is, that man is the victim of the environment with which he's surrounded. And of course, any thinking man would agree that there is a profound influence that environment exerts upon someone's life. But it is demonstrable that man is not determined by the contingencies of the circumstances that have surrounded him and the influences that have been brought to bear upon him. After I left university, I went to work in two very different parishes in Glasgow. One was in one of the worst and most appalling slum areas of Glasgow, where there was just about everything that is associated with that kind of social environment. The other was what was described as a garden suburb, very refined and very respectable. But I can only tell you that it was my experience as I got to know people there and came face to face in a way that perhaps a minister does that other people may not. And it's important for us, I think, to know that in these days when the television clergyman is so out of touch with life. I can tell you that there are areas of life that people like myself touch that others never know anything about. And having been for some 5 years between these two areas, I can only tell you that my experience was that the real problems and the real issues and the real nature of men and women were precisely the same in the slum as in the suburb. The things that divide them were ephemeral and superficial. The basic facts about them were precisely the same, and the basic problems they faced were precisely the same. Finally, there is the Christian view of man and the Christian explanation of this tension between what he was made to be and what he is. This high view that we hold of man and that almost everybody would adhere to, and the basic fact of what we see. This Christian view is that there is a revolt and an enmity in the heart of every man against the God who created him for himself. Having been made, as we were saying, with a capacity for love and for worship and with a will of his own, man has rebelled against God and has applied his capacity for love and worship to loving and worshiping himself. Now I want to try to support that as we go on. But this is the Christian diagnosis of the situation, that man's basic problem is that he is in revolt against the God who has made him, and the very capacities that mark him out as being made in the image of God, he has taken and applied not to love and worship and serve God, but to love and worship and serve himself. And this is the basic drive of his nature. The New Testament describes it in this way. They have worshipped and served, and it is talking about this thing that the New Testament calls by the unpopular name of sin. It describes it in these terms: they have worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator. And this is the diagnosis of man's basic problem. And it is from this that everything else flows out. The late Professor C.E.M. Jode, who for many years embraced a rational, optimistic philosophy of life, found his idealism shattered during the Second World War. And he came to see, as he once wrote, "Evil is endemic in man, and the Christian doctrine of original sin and rebellion against God expresses a deep and essential insight into human nature. Therefore," he writes, "for the first time in my life, the existence of God in the world made its impact upon me as a positive and obtrusive fact." There was a once famous correspondence in the London Times under the heading, "What's Wrong with the World?" And probably the most penetrating and certainly the most famous and most quoted letter in that series came from the pen of G.K. Chesterton, who wrote simply in these terms under the heading, "What's Wrong with the World?" And the letter read, "Dear Sir, I am yours sincerely, G.K. Chesterton." And that sums up the Christian position precisely. The heart of the human problem is the problem of the human heart. Jesus' diagnosis is soberly realistic. From within, he says, out of the heart of man come evil thoughts, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, ruthless greed and malice, fraud, indecency, envy, slander, arrogance and folly. These evil things all come from within, and it is they that defile a man. This is Jesus' diagnosis. Now, if you build upon the foundation that we laid last evening, that Jesus Christ has demonstrated himself to be not just a mere man, but God come in the flesh, we need to pay special attention to these words. It is, of course, upon this fact that William Golding has put his finger in his book Lord of the Flies, which, if you are familiar either with it or with the film which was made from it, you will know depicts a number of schoolboys in a plane who are landed on a desert island. And they soon become aware of some sinister tendencies amongst them which are about to destroy them. Innocent schoolboys, as it seems, with a different environment altogether. Here they are brought into this primitive place with none of the pressures of a modern civilization upon them. And Golding paints the picture of the gradual deterioration of relationships between them. And the boys become alarmed at what is threatening them. And they are beginning to seek for an answer to where this comes from. What is it that they need to be afraid of? And one of them, Ralph, says, "The answer is, I am afraid of us." Now this is it. This inner disease, which the Bible describes as worshipping and loving ourselves, has all kinds of manifestations, some of them very ugly, some of them well disguised. But you can understand almost everything that is amiss in human character in terms of this. For example, you take the problem of lust and adultery, which creates so much havoc in the world in our generation. So much of the psychological backwash of which I receive coming in my own daily life. What is at the root of this, when so often someone will come to someone else and use these overused words, "I love you"? Is it not true that what so many people are really meaning when they say this is, "I love me, and I want you. And this is the expression of this worshipping and loving the creature rather than the creator, and having turned around the divine order, so that we have put ourselves in the place of God and use other men for our purposes. Now, there are so many ways in which this comes out. The tragedy is that this rebellion, which is at the root of it, produces the opposite of what we expect. One of the basic things that man is depicted as seeking in the book of beginnings in the Bible is freedom, a word that is greatly used in the lips of many thinking people today. The freedom that we long for, we seek methods and pathways of discovering true freedom for ourselves in our daily life. And man, by his rebellion against God, thinks this is where he is going to find it. This is the temptation, if you read the account in the early chapters of Genesis, which are very penetrating. He wants freedom, and therefore he casts off all restraint. The rules that God has given him, the instructions that he has applied to him for living, he wants these all thrown off. And instead of finding freedom, he finds despair and misery. And that is precisely what modern man is discovering. See, it all depends what you mean by freedom. Let me pursue this a little further with an illustration. You think of a train which is made to run on two parallel rails. It's created like this. This is part of its essential being, and its true freedom is to be found in existing for the purpose for which it was created. Now, if that train, going along through the countryside and seeing some of the wide open meadows and spaces around, should suddenly get illusions of grandeur and say, "Why should I stay on these rails? Why shouldn't I go off and enjoy these wide open spaces?" And it does. And the immediate result is not freedom at all, but disaster. And this is precisely what man's revolt against God produces. But above all, it has separated man from the one source where he can learn what life is all about, namely from God. And it's his alienation from God which is the root of man's deepest despair. And worse still, he cannot find his way back. Now, precisely this is the reason that the man, Christ Jesus, came into the world. He is not only concerned to be realistic about our true need, but to show us the true value that man has in the eyes of God. You find Jesus coming simply because man is lost and unable to find his way back to the one who is able to bring him to the real meaning of life. He finds that he is staggering around like a blind man. Now, it's not without great significance that Colin Wilson, in his book The Outsider, subtitled An Inquiry into the Sickness of Mankind in the Mid-20th Century, titles one of his early chapters, The Country of the Blind. Man groping for meaning and purpose in life, and quite unable to find it. Now, Jesus came, as he says, to seek and to save that which was lost. He pictures man as a sheep lost from his shepherd, as a coin out of the hands of its rightful owner, and not able to be used for the purpose for which it was made, and as a son out of touch with his father. But Jesus kept insisting upon the value that God places upon man, upon an individual man, however insignificant in the eyes of the world. You are of more value, is Jesus' constant refrain in so many different connections. You are of more value than this. You are of more value than that. And the clearest evidence of the value he placed on man was his own purpose in coming into the world. He is the good shepherd who not only comes to seek and to save the lost, but lays down his life for them. And his death on the cross is the ultimate evidence, not only of how seriously God regards the problem of evil in the world, but of how highly God values the life of man. It was William Temple who wrote, "My worth is what I am worth to God, and that is a very great deal, for Christ has died for me." The starkest expression, you see, of alienation that was ever uttered was uttered by Jesus when he was dying on the cross, my God, why have you abandoned me?" And he comes into the alienation from God, which is the result of our rebellion, in order that we might be brought back to the God for whom we were made. What then is man's need? And with this I finish. It is patently not for good advice, or for a new environment, or for more time. This is the tragedy of that substitute for Christianity which presents to people either a table of commandments or good advice from the Sermon on the Mount, and says this is what Christianity is all about, because men come back from attempts to obey these things and they cry, "What I need is not a lecture but a savior." A man discovers that his need is the need of David, who prayed in the Psalms, "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me." Now the message of the Christian faith is that it is precisely this that God can do. He can raise men up into newness of life. He can create in you a new heart. He can take away the essence of what sin is all about and what it has done, and make you a new man. This is why Professor C.S. Lewis, who came, as he says, reluctantly to the Christian faith, was concerned to declare that God was not interested in making nice people, but new men. And authentic Christianity is all about that. That is why the attitude that men need to take as they come to God is not the attitude in the early language of the man we know in the New Testament as the prodigal son, who came with the language that is so common to man, "Give me." But at the end of the story, he comes to God a very different man, who has been ready to let the smoke screen that went up about his true self disappear. And he says, "Make me." And this is what God delights to hear and is ready to answer by making us new people in Jesus Christ. The way that he does this, by the death of Christ on the cross, will be our subject tomorrow evening. I'm very grateful to you for listening so patiently, and I hope we may have the opportunity of talking. I'm going to be available in the afternoons in a room in the Chaplaincy Center, and I hope that you may be able to take the opportunity of coming and talking about this then. It seems to me that these issues are too important for us to take lightly. And I hope that we are going to use this week to think with the utmost seriousness through them. Thank you for coming this evening.